The Doctrine of Spiritual Disciplines, the seventh talk in a series titled Modern Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, was presented by Wes Hurd on May 14, 1996, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Tonight's topic is entitled The Spiritual Disciplines, and this is coming under a series that we've been doing on basically alternatives, what we think are alternatives to the true biblical gospel. And a couple of weeks ago I did one on the prosperity gospel. Last week Jack did one on communalism. They're basically critiques of movements or teachings or doctrines or whatever that are floating around out there, mostly within the evangelical world, that is the Bible-believing, church-going world, that we think are off the mark, either a small bit or a large bit. And tonight is no exception. That's what this topic is all about. It's about a set of teachings that have, in some respects, been around for many centuries, that we think are, that I think, are misleading regarding the gospel. And so hopefully a little critique here tonight will help sort that out. A lot of what I'm going to be talking about tonight with regard to this, the disciplines, it comes out of this book, The Celebration of Discipline by Richard Foster, that was written, I think it was published in 1978. So this will be primarily what I'm referring to, although I want to make it clear that I think at the bottom, when you get to the bottom of the issues that are presented in a book like this, with the set of arguments that he's arguing theologically and spiritually, that there is a common ground with the so-called historic classical disciplines. There's a common ground with an orientation within the biblical evangelical traditional church that is very much the same, similar, if not identical in orientation. We can't address the topic of spiritual disciplines without getting some kind of context for what they are all about. So let me try to help put that, set that out first. Let me suggest that throughout church history, that the core issues of salvation, that is, the doctrines around soteriology, the doctrines and theology of salvation and the nature of our salvation, have been greatly debated. Obviously, the Reformation is only one site where great debates have taken place, although certainly that was a great schism in the church over the issue of salvation, that is, how we define the nature of salvation. So there's been a great intensity of debate over these issues. I think it would be fair to say that the core of these debates could be summarized perhaps by asking one or two questions. First, what is the true nature of man's need for salvation? That is, what is the essential issue that is at the core of man's need for God? Is our salvation, and I'll explain what I mean by these questions, is salvation a metaphysical problem? And I'll explain what I mean by this, spin this out. Is it a metaphysical problem, or is it a primarily a moral problem having to do essentially with the nature of righteousness. So that's at one end. That's one of the core questions. Another question that lies at the core is when it comes to this issue of salvation, what is God's role? What has God assigned for himself to accomplish for our salvation? And what has God given to man? What is man's role in our salvation? And these are central core, I put them quite simply, but these are the core issues that lie at the center of much of the debates of church history on the issue of salvation. Now, the subject of spiritual disciplines, the so-called spiritual disciplines, and these are called the spiritual disciplines. That is, there's a more or less a set of practices that someone can enter into called the spiritual disciplines or the disciplines. Now, the subject of spiritual disciplines touches on these issues. So it is of some importance that we are careful about what the spiritual disciplines are promising. Okay, so what do we mean by the spiritual disciplines? What are the spiritual disciplines? They are activities or practices that I do to avail myself of God's grace. Now, while it is true that God's grace... Now, this is a quote from Foster here. I'm going to do some quoting. And this is by way of spelling out what the disciplines are. While it is true that God's grace and righteousness is a free gift, we can be tempted, this is a quote, we can be tempted to believe that there is nothing we can do, nothing man can do. If righteousness is a gracious gift from God, and the Bible unequivocally states that, then is it not logical to conclude that we must wait for God to come and transform us? Strangely enough, the answer is no. That's Foster's position. God has given us the disciplines of the spiritual life as a means of receiving his grace. A means of receiving grace. God has given us the disciplines of the spiritual life as a means of receiving his grace. The disciplines allow us to place ourselves before God so he can transform us. Now, these are direct quotes. So, then the spiritual disciplines are things that I can do, and I should do them, in order to access or appropriate the grace of God. So now, what are the disciplines? In this very popular book, The Celebration of Discipline, although I haven't heard much said about it recently, I'm sure there are still circles out there where it has a great influence. This book, when it came out in 1978, was awarded the Evangelical Book of the Year. So this is no lightweight book. This was a serious book.
Is it popular?
Is it right now? Okay. Yeah, there's some interesting things going on out there. So in this book, Richard Foster presents what he calls the classical disciplines. These are disciplines that have been used throughout church history by the great saints great and small, known and unknown, and leaders of the church. They are models and examples today of a tradition of spiritual greatness that we have all but lost today. He argues that the loss of these practices of discipline has resulted in shallow teaching and shallow spiritual lives in the modern church. Foster argues that by recovering these classical disciplines, namely meditation, prayer, fasting, study, simplicity, solitude, submission, service, confession, and worship. And I think he divides those into, he subdivides those into the inward disciplines, the outward disciplines, and the corporate disciplines. So there are disciplines that have to do with just me and God, that focus on what he calls the inward path or the inward journey. And then there are disciplines like simplicity, solitude, submission, and service that have to do with things I do for other people, the way I live my life out. And then there are disciplines like confession, worship, guidance, and celebration that have to do with the body of Christ at large doing these together. So he argues that by recovering these classical disciplines, the believer and the church at large can deepen its true spirituality. These disciplines are classical, and this is a powerful quote, and a very powerful claim. These disciplines are classical not just because the church has been taught to practice them down through the centuries by such spiritual notables as George Fox, Francis of Assisi, Evelyn Underhill, and Thomas Kelly more recently, but because, in Foster's words, they are central to experiential Christianity. In one form or another, all the devotional masters have affirmed the necessity of the disciplines. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I think that even though we're referring in this, with this reference, I'm referring largely to the traditions of church history that go back many, many centuries. I think there are modern equivalents, and in fact, I think Foster, in his laying out his theology and his view of how sanctification occurs and what kinds of keys to the kingdom, so to speak, that we have in our own hands here, that he's greatly influenced by even someone as recent as Hannah Whitall Smith in the last century, a great devotional Keswick Victorious Christian Life teacher.
Can you repeat what he said there, essential to love?
That they're central to experiential Christianity, that is, Christianity that's really being lived out in my experience, rather than something that's an academic view of the world.
You mentioned something about he quoted something from the masters. What was that again?
He refers throughout the book to these disciplines as having a tradition that they've existed for a long time in the practices of the church, and he refers to, for example, such notables as George Fox, Francis of Assisi, others, Thomas Merton. He quotes a lot of people in church history that he claims were practitioners of the disciplines, and one of the reasons that they were great spiritually was because they did practice the disciplines. Does that answer your question?
Did he refer to them as masters or something?
Yeah, masters of devotion, devotional masters.
All right, that's what it was.
Right. I suppose that would be in contrast to academicians or scholastic theologians, people who are doing rational, you know, a lot of cognitive thinking and writing of theology about the nature of Christianity, that these are people who are focusing on the heart response, the inner response to God, this what they would call the heart spiritual response to God, rather than, again, just laying out scholastic theology or theology in general. Okay, now what are the origins of the concepts of the disciplines, as I've just mentioned? I think in general we can say that as we go back through church history, and certainly this is the perspective that Foster presents, that we look at the development of the church and find that there were orders and organizations and subsets of organizations that developed in the church who generated rules and guidelines for guiding people to the faith and for guiding people in how to practice the faith. So the rules and practices for ordering a monastery, for example, more than likely, it's hard to imagine a monastery that wouldn't have presented a set of rules and guidelines or disciplines for that order. And maybe there were certain variations in some of these things for them, but in general, they would have all been along this line here. Now, most of them, I would say, to a great degree, the disciplines, the concept of the disciplines, assume a Neoplatonic metaphysic. And I'll explain that in just a moment. A Neoplatonic metaphysic in which oneness with God or oneness with the One is achieved through meditative contemplation and the practices of an ascetic life. Foster and others who advocate the use and the central place of the disciplines will argue that early in church history, the spiritually great and unknowns found the disciplines to be their key to higher, deeper, more profound spirituality. In fact, Foster argues, goes back, looks at the Bible, and basically looks at certain texts that refer to the practice of, say, something in the Psalms, or another biblical character, even Jesus himself, as practicing one of these devotional disciplines. What they all recognize, and what they're all trying to get at, is that our human frailty and our sinful dispositions, that is, our orientation to sin and to break down and to fail in this life, that we're prone to what they would call a shallow spirituality. That's our bent. Our bent of sin and alienation from God leaves us in this place of weakness where even though salvation might be a very attractive and desirable thing for us, we're left in this place where we need some handles, we need some grips, we need to be able to do some stuff by choosing, making certain choices to place ourselves more and more and more in a place of spiritual strength and what he would refer to as a deeper spirituality, more profound spirituality, a deeper life, a deeper sense of our humanness. And that, I have no argument with that in the sense that who wouldn't want that? The question that comes up is, do the disciplines pull off what they claim they're going to pull off? Do they actually give you access to what they claim they're going to give you access to? So, on the one hand, I'm laying out a critique of the spiritual disciplines. On the other hand, what they're aiming for, what they want to try to help us with is, in general, a very biblical goal, with one major qualification, which I'll talk about. This would be a good place to come back and talk about the Neoplatonic metaphysic that I mentioned a minute ago. Now, this is a kind of sweeping generalization, but there was a following from the philosophy of Plato in the years and decades and centuries that followed that. There were alterations and developments that took his basic grid, Plato's basic grid of reality, his metaphysical ontological categories and grid, and built on them. I'm not a person who can help you a lot with that. If I did, I probably would stumble around and make a lot of mistakes. What I do know is what ended up in the Neoplatonic grid. Now, maybe I can take a minute. Jack, could you quickly outline the Platonic grid of the dualism of Plato?
Plato just believed that there was the realm of mind and rationality and ideas. There's also the realm of spirit. Well, it was the invisible realm. It was good and it was perfect. And then there was the physical realm of material and matter, and that was imperfect and ultimately evil. The realm of the good and the rational is ultimately moves toward unity, and the realm of the physical and material moves toward plurality and fragmentation. And Plotinus, who invented Neoplatonism, just ran with that.
Right. So basically what we have is that reality is made up of this dualism. One side of the dualism is mind, spirit, unity, rationality, good. The other side of the dualism is matter, plurality, diversity. Instead of unity, we have plurality and diversity, and this end of things is evil. So it's important here at this point to identify good and with the spiritual or the non-material, and evil with matter or the material or physical stuff. The Neoplatonic grid came along and sort of, quote, I want to say advanced on that, but embellished it and altered it slightly and gave it this kind of a twist. Namely, that at this end of things, we have God or the One, and where do we get the idea of the One from Plato's idea of everything is one, harmonious. There is an identification of good and the non-material or the spirit, and also the light, illumination, rationality, understanding, the mind. Yes?
Do you mean light metaphorically or photons?
Not physical light in the way that we think about light today, but in their mind, I think, light as a spiritual reality, that it is the way to understand what spiritual purity is.
Perhaps the same light that Jesus was speaking about, whether it's absent in the eye or not absent.
I think they would probably do that. I think they would make that connection of the use of light in the Bible as not just a metaphor, but actually a reference to a spiritual reality that is identified with good and pure holiness and purity and all those kinds of things. So, and then unity beyond all, I'm going to put this on here, beyond all multiplicity or pluralism or distinction, distinction, where we make distinctions between this and that. This is the area of oneness. Now, in the Neoplatonic grid, what they developed was a sense of a kind of continuum from this, which was light and non-material, and even in a sense, when you really talked about God, you were talking about a being that you couldn't talk about. There wasn't any way to talk about him. or talk about it. Then we had emanations or gradations of being that emanated from the source of being. God is the source of being, the source of all existence, and emanating from God is our states of being. The second state generally was called the level of nous, or the mind. And so this was in their grid sort of a grid of thought or mind or reason, rationality. This was close to God. And then they had another level of emanation of being, and that was the world, what they called the world soul. And then the last one was the emanation that of individual souls and nature, that is material nature and matter. Now, I'm sure that I'm generalizing here, but in general, you can see that what we're looking at here is something that is good, pure, light, in a sense, at its essence, unknowably pure, so pure and other than what we are as material beings that we can't even, as material beings, understand, fathom, or even talk about this up here. But in the Neoplatonic scheme of things, salvation would be moving from here to here. That is salvation. So when I ask the question, is salvation metaphysical? This is what I'm referring to. Is, or ontological, that is the nature of our being, is salvation the change in the nature of what we are, the stuff that we're made of? Is salvation being changed to the stuff that God is made of? Or does salvation primarily have to do with the issue of whether or not we are good or evil? Now, in this grid, they identify evil with matter and good with spirit. So it's not like they don't have a reference to the issue of righteousness and morality in their system. But what happens here is a kind of confusion, I think, a kind of blurring in their orientation that comes out as we begin to look at the nature of the disciplines. When we look at the nature of the practices of the disciplines, we begin to realize that what they're calling, what's being called for, and what's being promised, as Christianity and the gospel are sort of laid over this grid, is essentially a change in our spiritual or metaphysical or ontological nature, that as we become one with God, rather than an orientation that sees our primary problem as being a moral problem, that we are morally and righteously, we are immoral, unrighteous, evil, corrupt. And the primary issue at hand is whether or not God's going to transform my moral nature to one like His. Yes?
This sounds like a trick question, because part of my hope as a believer is to have an ontological change.
Right. I don't know exactly how to, maybe we can talk about that. It seems to me at this point that the way that helps me think about it is, does God have a problem with the nature of what I am in my physical nature? Or does God have a problem with what I am in my moral nature? I could live, I mean, it could be that God wasn't going to change me at all. There is no promise of any metaphysical or ontological change in my nature involved in my salvation. He's just going to fix my moral nature. And as far as I understand what the major issue, the central focus and issue of the gospel is, He's going to change me and make me into a being like Him in the sense that I share His holiness. I share his goodness. I think there is going to be an ontological change. It appears to me that it will happen at the resurrection. But the disciplines are actually promising and actually suggesting that there's actually a metaphysical, ontological change happening in this life. Yeah?
And the ontological change that is promised at the resurrection is still not this one.
Okay, could you speak to that?
Well, you know, really, when they talk about, when Neoplatonism talks about the one, they really mean the one, like you're saying, that's beyond distinction. So the one, in the one, there becomes no distinction between good and evil. There becomes no distinction between light and darkness. There's a loss of all distinction. There's a loss of all distinctness. It's just this one nothing. And to really be united with the one is to lose all individuality, because my individuality is part of the problem. That's consistent with evil. Well, that's not what we're talking about in the kingdom of God. I'm going to remain thoroughly evil. I'm going to remain thoroughly a creature rather than a transcendent being. I'm not going to be united with the transcendent being. I'm going to be a creature created by the transcendent being. So there's all kinds of huge differences between what the Bible is presenting as this new creation that I'm going to be and what they're talking about here.
Which, by the way, in the end, the idea of the one that he's talking about here is virtually identical to the Eastern concepts of monism and pantheism. So you see how when this kind of stuff gets identified and linked with the biblical ideas, there's a transformation of the gospel going on, transmutation of the gospel going on that we really need to be careful about. Okay, getting on then with the promises and the claims of the spiritual disciplines. How do we get this more profound spiritual life? Well, first of all, Foster says, the purpose of the disciplines, this is a quote, is liberation from the stifling slavery to self-interest and fear. That is, when one's inner spirit is set free from all that holds it down. What is the primary requirement of this at the bottom of the spiritual disciplines? And his word, and I'm quoting here, is a longing for God. Now, depending on how we define what he means by that, how he would define what he means by that, that could be fine. I mean, I use that kind of language myself a lot, to long for God. We see that kind of language in the Bible, for example. He says, he quotes from Psalms 42, the psalmist who says, as the hart, or the deer, longs for flowing streams, so longs my soul for thee, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. I mean, you find that kind of language in the Bible, but what is it talking about? The language, it's poetry. It's a poetic kind of communication and use of language, and so it is sort of artistically vague in a way. But I think if we do a sound biblical search of what the deepest needs and therefore the deepest longings of the human heart and soul are, and then we look at what the gospel offers us and what Jesus clearly is offering us, we see that the longing is not a longing, the psalmist is not longing to become one with God, but a longing that removes the alienation that it's there because I'm evil and God is not evil and God has nothing to do with evil. So there's an alienation and a separation that's occurring because of evil. And the longing is the longing for the removal and the solution to that evil. I think that's the way we should understand this kind of language. But you can see how he's using the language. A longing for God in Foster's mind and his way of thinking at things and in the disciplines orientation to spirituality and sanctification would be, a longing for God would be the longing of my soul to become one with God, to become the same stuff as God. In that sense, longing for God. He says, perhaps somewhere in the subterranean chambers of your life, you have heard the call to a deeper, fuller living. He claims that the disciplines offer us a path to follow in which the deepest longings for fellowship with God and the most profound experiences of sanctification will be ours. We must get past, he argues that we live in this materialist age in which we must get past our orientation to the physical and the material world, the materialism of our age, to see that only in the spiritual realm are man's deepest, truest longings met. There exists for us a spiritual realm that we may access which will put us in touch with the living God experientially. But it is a different path than our shallow, he would argue, a different path than our shallow modern evangelicalism typically teaches us. It's a path beyond the physical world into the realm of the spiritual, and it is a path made for us by the practice of these disciplines. When we despair of gaining inner transformation through human powers of will and determination, we are open to a wonderful new realization. Inner righteousness is a gift from God to be graciously received. The needed change within us is God's work, not ours. The demand is for an inside job, and only God can work from the inside. But then he goes right on to say, in the context of those quotes and paraphrases that I've just given you, that that inside job is one that we have to set up. And how do we set that up? We set that up with the practice of these disciplines. The spiritual disciplines, he says, are a way of sowing to the Spirit. That's a quote, an excerpt from Galatians chapter 6 and verse 8, where there is discussed there, there's a reference of sowing to the Spirit or sowing to the flesh. And he takes that text and uses it to talk about as a way of describing what the disciplines do, is they give you a way to sow to your spirit, to the Spirit, instead of sowing to the flesh. And these are taken out of context. They can get us to the place where something can be done. They are God's means of grace. The inner righteousness is not something that is poured on our heads. God has ordained the disciplines of the spiritual life as the means by which we are placed where he can bless us. Once we have lived in the way of disciplined grace for a season, we discover internal changes. So the picture that's emerging here is that the believer can rise above the mundane, stumbling, failing, inconsistent spiritual life by realizing that God has provided us with a means of grace, spiritual disciplines, that become the channels for receiving what God wishes for all believers, namely, victorious inner transformation of the self, the spirit, which begins to make true inner righteousness appear from within us. So the picture that we have is that these disciplines give us a channel. If we think of this little map on grid I'm drawing here of a human being and the circle as sort of the inner life, we could divide the circle in a way in two and say, let's say that the upper half of the circle, which is the inner life, is the psychological, and that the lower half of the circle is the true inner spirit. And I suppose in Foster's grid and way of thinking of things, he's saying that if I draw a W here in the upper psychological realm of my thinking and feeling and choosing and all that, and that W stands for my will, he's suggesting that I can choose to practice certain disciplines, practices, activities, whatever they may be, meditations, prayer, other kinds of things that will help me basically tap into, make choices that tap into the true inner spiritual me, where God will then act. I can tune myself in to what God is doing in the spiritual realm. And by tapping into that spiritual realm, release attitudes that will surface, that will come back and begin to actually transform me and actually activate and release righteousness, really real true righteousness in my life. Now, there's some fuzzy kinds of categories and confusions going on here, and maybe you can help me think about this because I'm still kind of processing this myself. To me, that he's confusing and sort of overlapping some categories that are really important to keep apart and to be able to make some distinctions about. For one thing, he's talking about a spiritual realm as distinct from the physical material realm. Again, we go back to the grid here and we see the orientation of the influence of this kind of a Neoplatonic grid. He's talking about real time righteousness. That is, he suggests in the book that, in fact, he says it, that getting in touch with the spiritual realm will result, if you practice these disciplines, in becoming actually a more righteous person who acts righteously, genuinely in righteousness. So in Foster's grid, the spiritual realm is overlapped. If we do this kind of thing, draw a circle here, the spiritual realm and the righteous realm and the realm of righteousness are overlapped. And I can't help but think at that point that it's this kind of movement that's going on in his thinking. That is, the closer we get to the spiritual realm, the closer we get to the righteous realm in this grid. Now, on the surface of it, that might sound correct, but stop and think for a minute. In the spiritual realm, there's a lot of stuff out there in the spiritual realm. And I'm not just necessarily referring to the demonic or the spiritually evil, but there's a distinction to be made between the nature of righteousness, that is moral purity and goodness and holiness, and the status of an ontological existence which is spiritual, that is a non-material existence. Those two are not the same. But they are the same here. They're not the same in the biblical grid. Yeah.
So is he saying that you can have righteousness in parts? Because it seems to me that to be righteous, it has to be all of you. Because if there's a part of you that's not righteous, then none of you is righteous. But in this case, if there exists some sense of righteousness in us, I can't even where I started now.
Well, let me take off from that. Maybe this is where you're going with that. Yeah, the question arises for me, if this is true, I mean, there's this question of sort of gradations of righteousness.
Right.
And if it's gradations of righteousness, is that going to produce true, pure righteousness? I mean, can I count on that all the time by my working these disciplines?
Go ahead. I guess my question is can there be gradations of righteousness? Because what I said before, a part of me is righteous, but a part of me is still not righteous.
Yeah.
Then can I say that I'm righteous?
Yeah.
I think
this question is really solved in some of the work that Jack has been doing in the last couple of years on what he calls the nature of the transformation of a subjectivity. Do you want to take just a second and talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, what I argue is that you need to make a distinction between your, what the Bible calls your heart or spirit on one hand, and what what is your basic fundamental moral nature, on the other hand, and that as regenerate people, born again children of God, my moral nature has not been transformed. I'm fundamentally evil and remain fundamentally evil. But my heart and my spirit has been made righteous. Although it is really righteous, there is a sense which the Bible would argue that you can mature in that righteousness. So there, at that level, the Bible, I think, would argue that there can be gradations, that you can be more or less mature. But what it means by that, it's not metaphysical. Like Russ is arguing, it's not at all metaphysical. It's moral. It's a question of to what extent am I irreversibly committed to the values of God and His kingdom. And to the extent that if I am irreversibly committed to them, I am what the Bible calls mature, or it usually gets translated perfect. But as I'm there to stay, I've landed, I've placed my hope permanently and irreversibly in the kingdom of God. To the extent that I'm still in any way at all double-minded about that, to that extent I'm not yet mature. So I think you can talk about gradations there. But gradations make the most sense if we're really going to talk about gradations in the Neoplatonic system, because that's what it's built on. Like Wes says, the closer you get to God, the closer you get to the spiritual, the more good you are, the more righteous you are. Whereas in the biblical view of things, apart from that notion of maturity, everything else is like Tina says, either you're righteous or you're not righteous. You're either justified or not right, or not justified. Your moral nature is either evil or it's good. And really, even fundamentally, my heart is either transformed to a righteous heart or it's not. It just so happens that we can grow in maturity in that. But still, the Bible doesn't hesitate to call a child of God righteous rather than a sinner.
What would you do with the identification with, or the non-identification with, the notion of the transformed subjectivity and what he's calling the spirit, inner realm of the spirit? How would you, are those totally different things, or would you redefine?
Well, I think you've nailed it. I mean, I really like what you're doing here, that you've nailed the distinction because the heart, the transformation of my heart, is purely and completely a moral transformation, not a metaphysical transformation.
In this one.
Right.
Pardon me?
In this one. What you just said is just what's on the board.
Right.
Right, right.
Right.
And I think you're right. I think he is completely blurring those distinctions, and he's trying to suggest that forsaking my physicality, the material and the finite physical being that I am, somehow can be equated with making a moral commitment to the things of God. And that just simply flat out isn't true. I mean, Paul explicitly says that in Colossians, that severe treatment of the body, which has the appearance of wisdom, but is of no value in the something of the flesh. I mean, that's a direct denial of everything that's underlying what he said.
Let me read a couple of excerpts from him to get a little bit more picture of what he's going at here. He says, the classical disciplines of the spiritual life call us to move beyond surface living into the depths. They invite us to explore the inner caverns of the spiritual realm. They urge us to be the answer to a hollow world. It is good, as John Woolman, who's one of his sources, counseled, it is good for thee to dwell deep, that thou mayest feel and understand the spirits of people. And I think in that, all that kind of language, he's talking about, again, tapping into, on this grid, he's talking about tapping deeper into the spiritual, wanting to move this direction metaphysically to becoming more spiritually. In this one, in this little illustration here, he's talking about tapping into that inner, the inner self, the inner, what he calls the inner spirit, the spiritual realm in you, that therefore then will automatically result in becoming more righteous. Now, how does he do that? Let me just read a couple of excerpts here. He talks about, here's a place where he identifies very strongly, I think, with this Neoplatonic grid. He says, It is hard to overstate how saturated we are with the mentality of popular science. Meditation, for example, if allowed at all, is thought of as a contact, as contact with a real spiritual world, is not thought of as contact with a real spiritual world, but as a psychological manipulation. Now he's denigrating the scientific view and saying, no, the real view, the real true view of spiritual, of real reality is that there is a spiritual world we can get in touch with. Usually people will tolerate a brief dabbling in the inward journey, but then it is time to get on with the real business of the real world. We need the courage to move beyond the prejudice of our age and affirm with our best scientists that there exists more than the material world. In intellectual honesty, we should be willing to study and explore this other realm with all the rigor and determination we would give to any field of research. So, again, I can't help but think that in the way he's thinking about things is this way, and that the identification of us as individuals is that we are spiritual beings, but that we have a problem, and our problem is, basically, we're not spiritual enough in the way that he's defining that. And again, he's referring there to, I think, a metaphysical change. The spiritual disciplines open the door. When we despair of gaining inner transformation through human power of will and determination, I think I read this earlier, we are open to a wonderful new realization. Inner righteousness is a gift from God to be graciously received. The change within is God's work, not ours. It is a grace that is given. He talks about the free gift of righteousness and things like that. The moment we grasp this breathtaking insight, we are in danger of an error in the opposite direction. We are tempted to believe there is nothing we can do. If all human strivings end in moral bankruptcy, and having tried it, we know it is so, and if righteousness is a gracious gift from God, as the Bible clearly states, then is it not logical to conclude that we must wait for God to come and transform us? Strangely enough, the answer is no. The analysis is correct. Human striving is insufficient, and righteousness is a gift from God. It is the conclusion that is faulty, for happily there is something we can do. We do not need to be hung on the horns of the dilemma of either human works or idleness. God has given us the disciplines of the spiritual life as a means of receiving his grace. That is the way with spiritual disciplines. They are a way of sowing to the Spirit. Let me just leap ahead here and read a couple of... He talks here about desiring to hear the living voice of God. And he's talking about meditation here in this excerpt. The discipline of meditation. And he says, but those who meditate know that the more frequent reaction to trying to meditate is spiritual inertia, a coldness and a lack of desire. Human beings seem to have a perpetual tendency to have somebody else talk to God for them. We are content to have the message secondhand. At Sinai, the people cried out to Moses, "You speak to us, we will hear. But let not God speak to us, lest we die." One of the fatal mistakes of Israel was their insistence upon having a human king rather than resting in the theocratic rule of God over them. We can detect a note of sadness in the word of the Lord. They have rejected me from being king over them. The history of religion is a story of an almost desperate scramble to have a king, a mediator, a priest, a go-between. In this way, we do not need to go to God ourselves. Such an approach saves from the need to change. For to be in the presence of God is to change. It is very convenient this way because it gives us the advantage of religious respectability without demanding moral transformation. We do not need to observe the American scene very closely to realize that it is captivated by the religion of the mediator. That is why meditation is so threatening to us. It boldly calls us to enter into the presence of God for ourselves, to tell us that God is speaking in the continuous present and wants to address us. He goes on and he says, It seems so difficult to bring people to believe that they can hear God's voice. Members of the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. have been experimenting in this field for some time. Their conclusion, we think that we are 20th and 21st century people. Nonetheless, we have hints that one can receive directions as clear as those given Ananias. Rise and go to the street called Straight. Why not? If God is alive and active in the affairs of human beings, why can't his voice be heard and obeyed today? It can and is heard by all who will know him as present teacher and prophet. How do we receive the desire to hear his voice? This desire is in turn a gift of grace. Anyone who imagines he can simply begin meditating without praying for the desire and the grace to do so will soon give up. But the desire to meditate and the grace to begin meditating is easy to distinguish between, and he talks about dreams and how we can learn from our dreams that God, these are messages that we can learn to interpret. And he talks about how to meditate, gives specific exercises. He says, there's a time for what he calls centering down, or what the contemplatives of the Middle Ages called recollection or recollection. It is a time to become still, to enter into the recreating silence, to allow the fragmentation of our minds to become centered. The following are two brief exercises that will aid you in centering down. The first one is simply called palms up, palms down. Begin by placing your palms down as a symbolic indication of your desire to turn over any concerns you may have to God. Inwardly, you may pray, Lord, I give you my anger toward John. I release my fear of my dentist appointment this morning. I surrender my anxiety over not having enough money to pay the bills this month. I release my frustration over trying to find a babysitter for tonight. Whatever it is that weighs down on your mind or is of concern to you, simply say, just say, palms down, release it. And he goes on and he talks about another meditative approach begins by concentrating on breathing. Having seated yourself comfortably, slowly become conscious of your breathing. This will help you get in touch with your body and indicate to you the level of tension within. Inhale deeply, slowly tilting your head back as far as it will go. Then exhale, allowing your head to slowly come forward until your chin nearly rests on your chest. Do this for several moments, praying inwardly something like this. Lord, I exhale my fear over my geometry exam. I inhale your peace. I exhale my spiritual apathy. I inhale your light and life. Then, as before, become silent outwardly and inwardly. Be attentive to the inward living Christ. If your attention wanders to the letter that must be dictated or the windows that needed to be cleaned, exhale the matter into the arms of the Master and draw in his divine breath of peace, and then listen once again. So basically, I mean, look, extrapolating from the nature of what he's suggesting here is that he's presenting in his book specific, doable practices, psychological, physical practices that you can do that he is suggesting will allow you to clear your mind. And on the one hand, clear your mind of the distractions of this world, begin to focus on the spiritual realm, on the spiritual realm in yourself, and focus on what he calls the inner reality of the living Christ in you, and that will cause, eventually, by practicing these things, the release of the power of Christ to perform and to give righteousness into your life. Now, what does that do to statements, Jack was alluding to one a few minutes ago, but what does that do to, or what does that say to a passage like the testimony of Paul in Romans 7, where Paul talks about coming to this recognition of what is good and right and righteous and crying out for it, but then realizing that he can't get it. He can't do it. The things I wish to do, I can't do. The things I hate, I end up doing. That's the language of Paul. So he's recognizing the call and the need to righteousness, the need for righteousness. But he's stating very clearly and very flatly that he's helpless to be able to access some kind of switch or button on himself that would release, put him into access to God's grace and save him. I mean, he cries out at the end of that passage, "Who will set me free from the body of this death?" And then he says that in the next verse, Christ is the only one. The gospel is what sets me free. The promise of the gospel. It's Christ that will set me free. But he doesn't say anything at that point about practices. And I don't really think we see that in the New Testament. Let me read something I copped from a paper that Jack wrote a few years ago called The Means of Grace. And by the way, I think this would be entirely appropriate for me to mention this paper, especially in relation to this subject. This paper called Explaining Means of Grace is available in the office, and if you're interested, and it's very helpful in laying out some of this. You'll have to get updates from Jack if he wants to clarify anything. I took a quote from this paper where Jack found a quote of Luther with regard to these issues, and it's very, very telling. Luther, as you recall, goes back to the Bible, to the text of the Bible, and does exacting exegetical work in the books of the Bible, in particular in Romans, and comes to this, at that point in history, what is a absolutely shattering revolutionary understanding that it's grace, the grace of God plus nothing, that gets our salvation accomplished. Let me read this quote. It's really a powerful one. This is from a treatise that Luther wrote called The Freedom of a Christian. "First, let us consider the inner man to see how a righteous, free, and pious Christian, that is, a spiritual, new, and inner man, becomes what he is." So he's addressing this very issue. "It is evident that no external thing has any influence in producing Christian righteousness or freedom, or in producing unrighteousness or servitude. A simple argument will furnish the proof of this statement. What can it profit the soul if the body is well, free, and active, and eats, drinks, and does as it pleases? For in these respects, even the most godless slaves of vice may prosper. On the other hand, how will poor health, or imprisonment, or hunger, or thirst, or any external misfortune harm the soul? It does not help the soul if the body is adorned with sacred robes of priests, or dwells in sacred places, or is occupied with sacred duties, or fasts, or prays, or abstains from certain kinds of food, or does any work that can be done by the body and in the body. The righteousness and freedom of the soul require something far different, since the things which have been mentioned could be done by any wicked person. Such works produce nothing but hypocrites. On the other hand, it will not harm the soul if the body is clothed in secular dress, dwells in unconsecrated places, eats and drinks as others do, does not pray aloud, and neglects to do all the above-mentioned things which hypocrites do. Furthermore, to put aside all kinds of works, even contemplation, meditation, and all that the soul can do, does not help. One thing and only one thing is necessary for Christian life, righteousness, and freedom. That one thing is the most holy Word of God, the Gospel of Christ." In other words, a belief in the promises of the Gospel. Faith, simple faith. So we see from this, for example, that the core of the Reformation, which was a re-examination of the biblical texts, it was based on that re-examination of what was the Bible really saying, was The core of the Reformation was that, one, sanctification or salvation requires an inner transformation of the person which no external practice can possibly bring about. God's grace is totally free and gratuitous and is in no way conditional on our being willing, responsive, diligent, or otherwise disposed to receive that grace. The Reformers understood Paul's argument in Romans that if something is a grace from God, it cannot be earned or merited by its recipient. The grace given on the condition that I practice X is not a grace by Paul's definition. So are the disciplines biblical? I don't think so. Even though in Foster's case, he goes to biblical passages and I think largely takes them out of context to argue his case for the existence of this kind of spiritual realm, for the existence of this inner spirit, and even for the practices of the disciplines that he lays out in his book. Do the disciplines work? Do they accomplish what they claim? What they claim is an inner transformation, that you have a path and an access and a means to tap into a spiritual realm which is coterminous with the Holy Spirit of God, which then in some way releases and activates the spiritual realm, causing righteousness to be released in your life. And it's the practice of this, of meditation, certain kinds of prayers, certain kinds of practices of solitude, etc., that get you in a place, I would say, psychologically in a place where then you can tap into the spiritual world. Now, he wants to argue that when that's going on, that's a spiritual happening that ultimately can result in righteousness, in a righteous transformation. I would argue that most of these disciplines, if not all of them, can be defined very concretely and very powerfully, clearly, as physical and psychological manipulations that can result in transformations of your psychology and your perspective, the same way any kind of practice at the psychological level, a disciplined practice of something at the psychological level, can alter what you're doing. But that's what Luther was just saying any wicked person could do. For example, if I have a smoking habit, a lot of people as Christians would want to say that's a spiritual issue, and if you use a discipline like this, for example, you could release yourself from this habit that is ultimately destructive and harmful. And yet the same thing can happen with people using other kinds of psychological techniques. They're attributing a spiritual reality to something that is largely, I think, a psychological reality, if not wholly a psychological reality. What about discipline? I'm running out of time here, but what about discipline in general? Is there a place for discipline in the Christian life? Is there a place for or a role for effort? Which, in the end, I mean, I think that's basically what one of the elements that Foster's trying to get at is there anything we can do? If the real gospel implies or infers that it's God has to come to us on his initiative and get it done, and he says that, and then he contradicts himself by saying, oh yes, but there's some things we can do. If it's true that God is the one who initiates, who accomplishes, and who brings about the transformation of our lives and our destiny, and it's all on God's grace and initiative, is there anything that we're called to do? And that's where I think I've taken some helpful thinking from Jack's paper that I just referred to earlier on the means of grace. And let me just close with these couple of observations here. If we want to talk about means of grace, not so much, not in terms of disciplines that I can do to access the Spirit of God, but rather means of grace that God uses. What are the means that God uses to graciously work in my life? In other words, I think to talk about a means of grace as a human activity is unbiblical. But to talk about means of grace as God's activity, God uses all kinds of things to manifest His grace and His transforming work in our lives. How does God do that? If we assume, for example, as I think the Bible teaches, that God's providential authorship of our salvation is a fact, anything, and everything, in a sense, is fair game or a possible instrument or means of God's delivering His grace to me, and therefore working to the completion and perfection of my sanctification. Things like trials, crises. What's going on when I go through a severe loss, a death, or a marriage breakdown, or adultery, or some other moral failure? What happens when, going through that horrible crisis, I am, as a believer, am shaken to my core and realize with clearer eyes how valuable the promise of the gospel is to me and how desperately I want to be something other than I am, an evil person? As well, it could be Bible study, or it could be prayer, or it could be a crime, or it could be anything that happens in my life that God chooses to use as a channel of His grace, in a sense. So we can talk about means of grace, but we have to invert it and suggest that instead of means of grace being something that I can do to release the Spirit of God and the grace in my life, as something God does to release His activity and work, transforming work in my life. Now, Jack talks about two other areas, two other sort of evidences, or in a sense prerequisites. These things have to be true in order for real salvation and sanctification to be happening in my life. Number one, they're evidences of sanctification in my life. One is that there's a desire and a striving on my part to choose righteousness over evil. That is, I'm an ongoing struggle in my life, seeing more and more clearly as time and the seasons of life go by that I want what is good, that I desire and hunger and thirst after righteousness rather than evil, rather than the things of this world that ultimately end in corruption. So a desire and striving after righteousness and a striving for understanding. That is, I want to understand righteousness and I want it to work its way out in my life. These two prerequisites, if you want to put them in that way, these two evidences of God's sanctifying work on my inner life could be manifest in a number of different ways that all come out to be strivings on my part, efforts on my part. These are efforts on my part that are not conditions for the receiving of grace. They are evidences, logical evidences of God's work in my life. Number one, a striving to choose good instead of evil. In other words, a constant kind of repudiation of the things that I see that are unrighteous and corrupt and evil in my life, and instead a striving to do what is good. Another one is prayer. I think It's not the practice of prayer, although certainly there's nothing wrong with someone deciding to set up a disciplined way of praying, but it's the expectations you have about that that I think tell the difference. But prayer, for example, is simply the expression and manifestation of a heart that cries out to God for help. I know that I'm a sinner. I know that I'm caught and trapped in my own evil, and what else am I going to do? A real believer, someone who really is striving after righteousness, is going to pray, is going to be that kind of a person who prays. And a commitment to understanding God's unique revelation in the Bible is another way of striving. Striving against evil, striving in my prayer life to cry out to God to help me, striving to understand what it is that God is doing, trying to understand God's perspective on the world and on me. That would involve, perhaps, hard work, hard effort in trying to understand what is the Bible saying? What is the biblical picture of the reality in the world? And then there are other things that happen to us and that become evidences of effort and striving on our part. One is we go out of our way at times to exhort and encourage each other. We confess our sins to one another. And we pay attention. If we're paying attention, we do see people around us that end up being examples to us of somebody else's striving. I see what's going on in his life or her life, and I see that struggle, and I see a determination and a commitment and a humility and the kind of character that really longs after being what God wants rather than what they want. And that becomes an example to me. And I want to be that. I want to be part of that. And that becomes another area of effort and energy. But these kinds of strivings and energies are not spiritual disciplines in the sense that they're tapping me into a spiritual realm. These are rather evidences that God is at work in my life and that I am recognizing in the end that it's God's working in the depths of my life at His initiative and His grace that indeed causes a kind of transformation in my inner life and the inner me, and what we call around here sometimes our subjectivity, that is the real me at the core of who I am, that is something that doesn't always end up evidencing itself in right choices or in righteous choosing, but something that, even when there's a failure, admits that failure, repudiates that failure, and strives and goes back to striving for what is right and what is good. And that kind of energy, that kind of effort, I think is the kind of energy and effort and discipline, if you want to put it in those terms, that the Bible really calls for. I need to quit. We're way over time here. If you want to talk a little bit afterwards, I'll stay and be glad to chat with you. Thank you.